So I am noticing that my co-presenters, I'll just wait because people are talking at the back and I see Jim Richardson can't hear. When Jim does this, I know to stop. It's on. This is my quiet self, Jim. Come forward. Come forward. I'll yell at you, I promise. My co-presenters are sitting not beside me, and I'm suspecting it's because I'm going to talk about atheism. I'm not sure. We'll see. So the title of my paper is A Conversion Experience, Prayer as Culture and Heritage. And I'd like to start by telling you a few stories from Canada. The first one is about Oliver Arezzo in 2013, petitioned in the Ontario Superior Court for an exemption for his two high school-aged children to get out of religious retreats held by his children's Catholic high school. He had chosen the school not because he's a devout Catholic. Catholic high schools in Ontario are public schools, by the way. It's an odd constitutional anomaly in Canada. And he had chosen the school because it was near to his house and because he felt that it offered a superior quality of education to some of the other schools available to his children. So he asked for exemption from religious retreats. It was denied by the school board, and then he appealed to the court, and the court said, yes, your children can be exempt from those retreats. This year, in February, the news reported that another student from another Catholic high school filed a complaint with the Ontario Human Rights Tribunal. She claimed that her request for exemptions from religion class, the request had resulted in discrimination and prohibitions on her attending other school events like school field trips. She says she chose the school because of its science and math program, not because she's a devout Catholic. She also wanted out of religion class because she wanted to focus on more serious and rigorous academic subjects. 2 years ago, the Ottawa Humanist Society stood outside of a Catholic high school handing out get out of religion class free cards, mimicking the Monopoly game, for those of you who don't know Monopoly. It's too long to explain. And they wanted simply to make students aware that they could, in fact, get out of religion class, that that's an exemption that's allowed. They only have to request it. And then several years ago, the story of an atheist parent's objection to the distribution of Gideon Bibles to his child's school made the news. These cases are all from Ontario, the Canadian province of Ontario, but I could tell you others. I could tell you many others, but these are just a few to tantalize you and to whet your appetite for what's to come. He proposed to distribute Just Pretend, a free thought book for children. The school board declined his offer, arguing that schools have the right to sponsor the study of all religions without imposing the view of any particular creed. Atheism, they said, isn't a religion, and the suggested text, that would be the Just Pretend Free Thought book for children, was a quote-unquote secondary publication as opposed to a, quote, globally recognized sacred text like the Bible. Eventually, they were banned from distributing the Bible as well. So this particular paper that I want to deliver today, I'll try to speak to it and read parts of it, and you'll give me a time warning, right?
At some point. Sure.
Good. Yeah.
I'm very strict on that.
Okay, excellent. I'm glad you're very strict because we know we don't want the session to go on for 5 hours, right? Or the Germans will complain. So, on the first day, which was yesterday and yet seems so long ago now, I just want to pull you back into that opening panel, those opening comments. Adam Posamai, for example, he made an interesting distinction. He mentioned both the religious and the atheist. And I'm really more interested, although the cases I've mentioned deal with atheists, I'm really more interested in those people in between. The category of nones, N-O-N-E-S. So those are the people I'm focusing on today, although I'll focus primarily on one case that is involving an atheist, but we'll get to him in a bit. So Adam mentioned the religious and the atheist. Giuseppe mentioned social and cultural contexts and the importance of those, and he specifically mentioned freedom from religion. Silvio mentioned apostasy and the right to change or abandon one's religion as a site of tension between the rights of God and the rights of human beings. So I'd like to draw out this. I think I'm the only one at this conference who has talked about this, and I forgive, please ask your forgiveness if someone here has also talked about this. But my basic argument is that we can't consider religion and human rights without also considering non-religion. I do work on religion too, but for right now, I've become very interested in what the tensions around this issue of non-religion and the religious and the non-religious. I think the three, human rights, religion, and non-religion, are inextricably linked. And I'll focus on Canadian cases, but I want to make the case quite strongly that these issues are emerging around the globe. And I would invite you, as I talk about the Canadian case, to think about your specific country and the case that might fit into the sort of discussion or model that I'm drawing on. So first I want to talk just for a couple of seconds about nuns, not as in the sisters, but as in the nuns non-religious, also known as secularists, humanists, atheists, agnostic, the spiritual but not religious, the uncommitted, the unconcerned, and the indifferent. Those are just some of the names. Nuns are rising, the percentage of nuns are rising in a wide range of countries. I was just talking with Ringo yesterday, who tells me that in Estonia, people who identify as non-religious are around 60%. I think that's one of the higher numbers that I've heard. Also, Britain, I was talking with Linda Woodhead a few weeks ago, and she said that she's written a little piece that says non-religious are up around 50%. And in a YouGov, I think it is, survey that she's done. Canada, 25%, about. Australia, did I say that like a Canadian? Australia, the same, around 25%. The US, almost 25%, and so on and so forth. So I'm interested in this group and what they're doing, and particularly around the issue of human rights and how that ties in and plays in with religion specifically. It's an understudied category so far, and the rise of the nuns has also foregrounded the inadequacy of understanding religious identity using traditional categories and measures, as well as the challenges of overemphasizing religion as an identity category. And I know that's why we're here. I know we're here to talk about religion. I'm just trying to throw a little something extra into the mix. The contours of this group, the non-religious, has yet to be fully explored, but it's clear they also deploy values and engage in practices related to their identities as nuns. For some, this may include opposition to organized religion, and for others, to any presence of religion in the public sphere. And those bits of things I told you about at the very beginning fall into that. And a core focus of my research is thus an increasingly on this group and on an increasingly complex future that includes not only diverse religious and non-religious populations, but also, and I think most importantly, the relations between those groups. So those are the nuns. For the purposes of this discussion, what's of most interest to me are not the legal wins and losses of atheist attempts to use court challenges or use the courts to challenge religion, but the ways in which the courts conceptualize atheists and non-religion in those processes. And also, and I'll touch on this a little bit later, reactions to decisions involving atheists. And Adam, you've heard part of this story of the case I'm going to tell when I gave a talk in Australia not so long ago, a little bit over a year ago. But the story continues because we have another layer of court decision. So, in other words, what is the narrative about non-religion, and how does it frame a particular way of seeing that shapes how non-religion fits into the broader scheme of legal protections? Though perhaps surprising, the issue of the origins of values plays out in legal contests as as a subtext of the arguments. So things like, without God, how will we know what is right? How will we know who we are? How will people know right from wrong? And I've sort of touched on that already. So contrary to the argument of atheists that one can be good without God, legal discourse is contributing, I argue, to the shaping of a new rhetoric that reinforces the foundational nature of religion to the common good. An idea that presses even those who don't believe to believe. The universal truth of religion becomes, in this conceptualization, inescapable and impossible to opt out of. The legal rhetoric has increasing traction in a number of Western democracies whose majoritarian religion would seem to be in decline. Laws coming to the rescue, though, securing religion's place as fundamental to societal well-being and as an important part of cultural heritage, but only particular kinds of religion. And so in an odd way, this is where religious minorities meet atheism. It's a strange bedfellows, I suppose. So I've written about the shift from religion to culture, or to reference back to the title of this paper, the conversion experience of prayer, in several places, including an article entitled Battles Over Symbols, which focused primarily on the Laozi case from Italy. So it's appropriate, I suppose, that I would speak about this here today. And that came before the Grand Chamber of the European Court of Human Rights. And I'm imagining that most people in this room are familiar with this case. Quite succinctly, the presence of majoritarian religion in the public sphere and public institutions, either through practices or symbols, is increasingly being framed and defended as being about our culture, our heritage, and our values in Western democracies, and not about the protection of religion. So when religion becomes culture, it's not a matter of calling out religion to reveal its true nature. I'm not really interested so much in definitions of what's really religion or what's really culture. Rather, it's important to ask, what does this shift in a production of a particular set of symbols, practices, and techniques enable? What are its real consequences? Or what is the work such a reconfiguration does on the ground? By constituting the thing formerly known as religion, a little reference to Prince there for those of you who got it, as culture, so religion becomes culture, a different kind of imaginary about who we are is constructed that then makes possible the denigration, exclusion, and even hatred of what is designated or constructed as religion. It also makes it very difficult to challenge, because it becomes something that's a cultural practice or heritage. And people who challenge those things are bad citizens. To reference back to Eileen's talk yesterday on new religious movements, we see something similar happening to people who would challenge these so-called cultural symbols. So a quick mention of the Canadian version of this story. In terms of nuns and how they've been represented or mentioned in law, non-religion has had a somewhat consistent, though abbreviated, place in legal discussions about freedom of religion in Canada. So it's another thing. It's always coupled with a discussion of freedom of religion. An important early case in Canada that came just after our Charter of Rights and Freedoms was enacted in 1982. Was a decision involving Sunday closing laws. And it's a case known as Big M, for those of you who know any Canadian case law at all. And that case made specific mention of the non-religious. And I'll just read you a little quote. It says, to the extent that it binds all to a sectarian Christian ideal, the Lord's Day Act works a form of coercion inimical to the spirit of the Charter and the dignity of all non-Christians. In proclaiming the standards of the Christian faith, the Act creates a climate hostile to and gives the appearance of discrimination against non-Christian Canadians. It takes religious values rooted in Christian morality and, using the force of the state, translates them into a positive law binding on believers and non-believers alike. So we have a first mention post-charter of non-believers. The Supreme Court of Canada clearly contemplated the protection of the non-religious, described as non-believers, and non-belief, stating, equally protected and for the same reasons are expressions and manifestations of religious non-belief and refusals to participate in religious practice. Maybe you can start to see why I need to combine, or I insist that we need to combine this conversation about religion and human rights with also a conversation about non-religion. Although included in the legal imaginary, nuns have not, until the Saguenay case, which will take up most of the rest of my time today, been a party to a case before the Supreme Court. And of course, I should mention, as I was thinking about this, atheists are present because atheists are probably the only group of the nuns, N-E-S, who have a mechanism for organizing as a group. They're present, often organized as groups, so they have the capacity to be involved in legal cases where people who are indifferent don't, really. They can only come before the law as individuals. So the impact of nuns on Canadian society, though, is clearly within the court's line of vision, as is illustrated by a statement from a recent case involving a Roman Catholic high school. And that high school sought to be exempted from the Quebec has a course called Ethics and Values, and it's sort of its version of education about religion, if you will. And the Catholic high school sought to be exempt from that course, which is mandatory for every school in Quebec to teach. The Catholic high school said, you know what, this is such a watered-down version of Catholicism and everything else, so we really don't want to teach it. And the court said this: the religious portrait of our society is a key factor in the adoption of a policy of neutrality, not only in Quebec, but also elsewhere in Canada. As a result of globalization of trade and increased individual mobility, the diversity of religious beliefs in Canada has increased sharply over the past decades. So the court is recognizing, sort of drawing on some sociological facts and recognizing them. The 2001 Census of Canada listed approximately 95 religious groups that were large enough to be considered separate religious institutions for the purposes of statistical records. Furthermore, more than 23% of Canadians declared that they were members of non-Christian religions or reported no religious identity. So, however, even though there's this presence of non-religion in the law in Canada and in human rights complaints, there's also a counter-narrative about nuns that circulates through legal conceptualizations of religion, and that's where I'm headed next. So the Saguenay case. Let's see if I can just give you the facts, tell them without necessarily reading anything from this, because it's just easier. Oh, but first I want to start with a prayer. Oh, that's good. Okay, so a prayer. O God, eternal and almighty, from whom all power and wisdom flow, we're assembled here in your presence to ensure the good of our city and its prosperity. We beseech you to grant us the enlightenment and energy necessary for our deliberations to promote the honor and glory of your holy name and the spiritual and material happiness of our city. Amen. So that's the prayer that Alain Simoneau heard when he went to municipal council meetings in Saguenay, Quebec. And the Saguenay case is about Alain Simoneau and his experience in that setting. So not only was there a moment of prayer, there was also a crucifix hanging on the council chamber walls, and there was also a statue of the Virgin Mary. Now, Mr. Simoneau objected mostly to the prayer. He said, the statue, the crucifix, you know, I don't really think they're appropriate in a council chamber, but I can put up with them. But the prayer, no. And the council even changed the wording of the prayer so that it was supposedly less denominational, if you will. Here's the new prayer. Almighty God, we thank you for the many favors that you've granted Saguenay and its citizens, including freedom, opportunities for development, and peace. Guide us in our deliberations as members of the Municipal Council and help us to be well aware of our duties and responsibilities. Grant us the wisdom, knowledge, and understanding that will enable us to preserve the advantages that our city enjoys so that everyone can benefit from them and we can make wise decisions. Amen. That was the new non-denominational prayer. Yes. So, Monsieur Simoneau files a complaint with the Quebec Human Rights Commission. The Quebec Human Rights Commission finds that there has indeed been a violation of his rights, but refuses to proceed to the commission, which is how this process works. They said, we're not going to, but you can. Monsieur Simoneau then is joined by the Mouvement Laïque Québécois, or Québécois, And the two of them, so he now has some kind of organizational backing behind him, the two of them file a complaint and proceed to the tribunal. The tribunal hears evidence from all kinds of people. The city calls evidence about the non-religious nature of the prayer, the crucifix, and the statue. They call in the artist who's made the crucifix, who talks about the religious nature of the statue, or of the crucifix, pardon me. And the city also calls in experts to talk about the nature of the prayer and its meaning. So they had experts who actually said that the prayer was not religious, was not denominational, and that testified that the crucifix, statue, and the prayer represented universal values, and that the state therefore had a duty to protect those universal values and also these representations of culture and heritage. The tribunal found that, quote, the reciting of a prayer and the exhibiting of religious symbols in the state-controlled space constituted by the meetings of the municipal council, where representatives of the people discuss questions of public interest, also have a non-trivial exclusionary effect that substantially stigmatizes people who do not share those values. So the tribunal found in Monsieur Simoneau's favor. Then the city of Saguenay appealed. And the Court of Appeal accepted the city's arguments. The court accepted the argument that the prayer and artifacts were not really religious, that they were cultural and heritage value, that the state could adopt what it called a benevolent neutrality, that the expert called by the Mouvement Laïque and Monsieur Simoneau was not a reliable expert, that any harm to Monsieur Simoneau was trivial. The Court of Appeal relied on the Lausy decision from the European Court of Human Rights Grand Chamber to support the idea of the cultural and heritage value of the prayer, the crucifix, and the statue, and the universality of the values that those represent. On the cultural features of the artifacts, the court transitioned them to have a secular status. The court said, and for those of you who know Lausy well, this is maybe memories of Justice Bonello here. This is the court. The Quebec Court of Appeal, to be clear. Indeed, things that were once closely linked to specific religious dogma have since become secularized. Given this new context, they cannot, in my view, said the justice, be removed in the name of a draconian conception of state neutrality. What would be the point of such a result if these things, despite their original meaning, were merely passive witnesses to history? So again, resonances of Bonello there. The idea that core universal values are represented by majoritarian religious symbols and practices such as prayer is reflected in statements made by the mayor of Saguenay and the experts who gave evidence for the city in the case. The mayor said the prayer was inclusive. And he, by the way, made the sign of the cross before he said the prayer every time. The mayor said the prayer was inclusive and that, quote, the municipal council decided to pursue the tradition of reciting the prayer, which was considered an important one, underpinning the foundation of the city, the values to be upheld, and the development of families. Quote, the values expressed by the prayer at issue are universal and cannot be identified with any particular religion. According to the experts, this prayer is consistent with modern theistic doctrine, open to some reasonable, non-invasive, and religious particularities. So while the tribunal had rejected the expert testimony that the prayer was not religious and universal and reflective of common values, the Court of Appeal of Quebec took the opposite approach. One expert described the prayer as not being just for Christians, but as part of a theistic modernity. In addition, she noted that in the present context, interpreting attachment to a prayer as evidence of the submission of those in authority to a higher power is abusive and does not take into account so-called religious modernity. So in other words, Monsieur Simoneau was being abusive in his arguments that the prayer should go. Another expert further said the prayer recited is appropriate for a large number of religions, and that this is an example of, quote, where the values of tolerance and openness to diversity that are necessary for life in a society like ours should prevail. The Saguenay case went on to go to the Supreme Court of Canada. It went in the fall of 2014, and the decision was released on April the 15th. You probably can tell by my tone that I already think the decision of the court to overturn the Quebec Court of Appeal was the correct decision. the Supreme Court did overrule the Court of Appeal on the issue of prayer only. They held unanimously that its recitation before council meetings infringed on Monsieur Simoneau's right to freedom of conscience and religion, and that it was indeed a violation of state neutrality. It did not, for procedural reasons, the Supreme Court did not consider the crucifix or the statue. It's therefore possible that the court could in future follow the Saguenay Court of Appeal reasoning and hold that a symbol previously considered to be religious is cultural and of heritage value, as well as being representative of universal values. Indeed, the court left some room for such an argument to be made. The city of Saguenay compared its prayer to that being said in Canada's parliament every time parliament sits. And the Supreme Court refused to make any comment on that because they said there was not enough evidence, they didn't see enough evidence through the trail of the decision. So there was not enough evidence led on that specific prayer. And the Supreme Court also said that the non-denominational nature of the prayer had not been proven. So in other words, it leaves open the possibility that this could be a finding in the future. What a non-denominational prayer might look like and how it could be inclusive of those who are not religious remains to be seen. And while the Supreme Court stated that the state could not use the guise of culture and heritage, it left open the possibility that some religious practices might be able to pass the requirement of state neutrality. So while the Supreme Court explicitly rejected the Court of Appeal's formulation of a benevolent neutrality, it left open the possibility that religious symbols could be considered culture and heritage. And I want to say that this is not unreasonable, but the Quebec Court of Appeal's decision and those of other courts in other countries should alert us to the ways in which law can and does reframe religious practices and symbols as culture and heritage in a manner that preserves majoritarian religion. By so doing, those who are non-religious and those who are religious others are excluded from both the past and the present constitution of society and nation, but also, in the case of non-Christians, able to be vilified as religious while in a so-called secular society with symbols and practices that carry on culture and tradition. So it sets up a certain class of citizen, if you will, who is essentially excluded from the story of Canada. And I would suggest any other nation where these sorts of arguments are being played out. So those are the cases. But it seems to me that discussions of human rights often remain at the level of abstract political, legal, and philosophical theories and considerations. And I think the important challenge to human rights is a sort of buy-in at the local level or the grassroots level. And I know some of you here are working on that, including EFI-Focus project based in Greece. So it's important to consider for a brief moment, I think, the reaction to this case in Canada. And this is where I think things get really, really interesting. Basically, pandemonium broke out. People were incredibly hostile to the idea, or some people were incredibly hostile to the idea that the Supreme Court had said you couldn't say prayer before municipal council meetings. To be quite honest with you, the fact that municipalities were still saying prayers before municipal council meetings came as a shock to some of us, to many of us actually. I had a brief career as a municipal council member, and in fact as a deputy mayor at one point, just for a short period, and we didn't say a prayer at the beginning of our municipal council meetings, and it wasn't something that was commonly practiced in those municipalities whose meetings I also attended. So I'll just give you a few examples of some of the quotes from some of the people who reacted, and these are from the media. I heard some of the stories on the radio, but these are from newspapers. You don't need to know where they're from, I think, because in this context, I think there are only two other people in the room who would even know the places I'm talking about in Canada, because a lot of them are really small places like Cape Breton. But some of them are larger municipalities like Toronto. Anyhow, one mayor said, "One way or another, we will do the prayer, and if I have to do that prayer in a public hallway outside the chamber, that's what I'll do." Another mayor said, "Okay, thanks." Another mayor said, "Personally, I'm disappointed and I don't support it. Canada was built on Christian law. We've shown tolerance to all faiths, and I'm not about to erode our principles. The Prince Edward Island Legislature, which is a small province on the east coast of Canada, said they're going to keep on saying the Lord's Prayer, a prayer for the Queen, she'll be relieved, and another for the Legislative Assembly. The Assembly's clerk made reference to the historical nature of the prayer, saying, "The same prayers have been recited in the House since the late 1800s and are part of daily proceedings. When it comes to saying prayers in the House, the Legislative Assembly regulates its own internal proceedings and claims parliamentary privilege associated with its own business." In other words, we're going to keep doing what we've always been doing. Canadians turn to culture, heritage, custom, and our values. Very few defended the prayer as explicitly or solely religious. A forum in the Toronto Star on the ruling illustrates the sorts of ways in which the recitation of prayers was constructed by readers. Here's one quote. "We shouldn't feel too upset with the Supreme Court's ruling on prayer before council meetings. We can still engage in private prayer whenever and wherever we choose. But it seems to me that much of our culture is being slowly stripped away, a culture steeped in tradition and passed on to us by our founding forefathers." We don't have foremothers in Canada. "It's sad that there are those who feel threatened by these traditions and find it necessary to deprive the vast majority of Canadians of this precious heritage so that they themselves can feel comfortable living in Canada." And that's a sort of veiled bit of mudslung at a kind of immigrant Canadian who they're imagining has prompted all this, when in fact Monsieur Simoneau is a, you know, 6th or 10th generation French Canadian who's initiated this complaint. But there's this sort of, it's brought out all kinds of other interesting things. The other thing that I should mention is that an Angus Reid poll done found that I think it was 56% of Canadians were actually in favor of the decision. And there was another, 65 or 70% said that they didn't think there should be any ritual before municipal council meetings. So it was an interesting, there was a kind of rhetoric around the majority of people and a small minority and so on. But when you look at, again, the 25% of people who have absolutely no religious identification, and also the Angus Reid poll, that was a bit of maybe an overstatement. I'll tell you about one radio program I heard, and the radio program I heard was the Fredericton, New Brunswick Municipal Council debating what they would do. And when a minute of silence before the council meeting was proposed, two of the councillors wanted to keep the prayer, and that was that. And one of them said, on a radio interview, said, "Well, if you have a minute of silence, people can think about anything. People will be thinking about their grocery list." So, anyhow, so these were examples, and I have more examples, but I've been given the 3-minute warning about 2 minutes ago.
No,
so,
no.
Am I?
1 minute.
I have one minute, but I also have a conclusion, so I think I should just, you know. So, there were lots of examples of this sort of resistance, but then also people who said, okay, we'll step in line. A unique piece of uniquely Canadian kind of twist on this was that some people said, well, that decision really only applies to Quebec and not the rest of us, because there are some who like to divide Canada into Quebec and the rest. So there were all kinds of interesting dynamics to this. So, to get to my conclusion, what then are we to make of these cases, and what does this tell us about social and legal construction, the social and legal construction of majoritarian religious practices as culture and heritage? I argue that the Saguenay case represents a broader trend in Western democracies to exempt majoritarian religion from legal scrutiny. Most of these regimes have constitutional protections of religious freedom, and some sense that states should not favor one religion over another. By situating majoritarian religion as culture and removing it from the realm of religion, the state is then able to justify its protection. Indeed, the state is called to protect practices and symbols that exemplify the nation's culture and heritage. The situation is particularly complex because of the decline in religiosity. Canada, Australia, most of Europe, all on traditional measures, as I've already mentioned. However, there is still, at some level, a predominance of identification with majoritarian religion, and it permeates social institutions. Moreover, this religion turned culture and heritage is validated as essential to the moral fabric of most nations. Thus, challenging it is seen as unreasonable and characterized as not only a failure to be religious, but a lapse in good citizenship, radicalness with its attendant connotations these days, or even mental illness. And you should know that one of the experts called by the city in the Saguenay case testified that he felt that Mr. Simoneau was exhibiting signs of a psychosis for even bringing the complaint. Law has become a key collaborator and even driver of this mode of framing religious rituals and practices. Though I use the Saguenay case as my point of departure and my analytic focus, the legal construction of religion as non-religion is an increasingly pervasive legal solution to the problem of the non-religious. Yes, I get it. I'm coming to the end. Look, see, just that much. Law does not constitute the social context, but is a collaborator in a reflexive and relational partnership with social discourse. Two quick points to end. What does this mode of characterization do to religion? What's the cost of being cast as an historical relic? For those for whom religion is an important force in their lives, does such a characterization reduce perhaps cherished beliefs and practices to history and culture? What are the long-term consequences of cordoning off religion in this way? If religion is culture or heritage, for example, can it speak to contemporary issues with any authority at all? Second, majoritarian religion does form part of the cultural landscape. How can that fact be acknowledged and even celebrated without misusing it to exclude, shut down, and discriminate, or to preserve a particular kind of religion at a cost to others in increasingly diverse social landscapes? It may be that a balance can only be struck at the local level rather than through the abstract general principles. It's clear that as majoritarian religion loses its privilege, this balance will become an important public discussion and is a key element in the discussion of religion, non-religion, and human rights. Thank you. Okay.